Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We are opening this hour by talking with John Doherty. A recent Pew survey suggests that the decline of Christianity in America may be leveling off. Now, I want to provide a short historical context here. The United States as a nation brought about some of the greatest flourishing we have seen in the past 200 plus years of its history on a socio-political perspective because it stood upon a few pillars, one of which is a constitution that was well reasoned out and appeals to Judeo-Christian frameworks and natural law, which again is appealed to by Judeo-Christian frameworks. Secondly, that this was grounded upon the dignity of the human person and the capacity for man to be self-governing in a moral, virtuous society. And thirdly, therefore, by virtue of the first two, in elected government and elected officials, we had the grounding of mainline Protestantism that created a kind of spiritual framework for the nation. That's declined terribly. But this recent Pew survey suggests that the decline of Christianity in America may be leveling off, because what history has shown is when Christianity flourishes and society respects religious liberty, societies flourish. The decline we are seeing in society is directly correlated to that decline. And hopefully we're seeing an upswing. We are seeing that in statistical levels across the world and perhaps even here in the United States. We then go on to speak with Daria Little. Daria and her testimony moves me tremendously. She was born and raised in Muslim Turkey, but after her parents' divorce, she rejected her faith, wandered the wilderness of atheism looking for her home. And during her stormy adolescence, she tried to convince a Christian missionary that there was no God, but instead was converted to Christ. Her story demonstrates how the God of the universe appeals to even our emotions, our sentiments, the deepest cores of our being, and the gift of our intellect to reason truth. All this after the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, May 19th. It's the feast of St. Pope Celestine V. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. Former President Joe Biden has prostate cancer, which has spread to his bones. His office made the announcement yesterday and said the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive, which would allow for more treatment options. President Trump wished former President Biden a fast and successful recovery in a post on Truth Social. Pope Leo XIV formally began his ministry as head of the Catholic Church yesterday, speaking to an estimated 150,000 people at his inauguration mass. He expressed his desire for a unified church. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio were among the foreign leaders in attendance. President Trump says direct peace talks between Russia and Ukraine will begin immediately. In a post on Truth Social, Trump said his call with Russian President Vladimir Putin about the war with Ukraine went very well. The two leaders spoke for almost 2 hours on Monday, and Trump suggested the talks could take place at the Vatican. According to the Russian media, Putin called the talks frank and substantive. Trump said he spoke with Ukrainian President Zelensky and other world leaders after the call. And the Supreme Court is handing President Trump a victory over the status of some Venezuelan migrants. The High Court lifted a lower court's injunction that blocked the termination of a program that protected the status of the migrants on Monday. It allows the Trump administration to end the temporary protected status program for about 350 Venezuelan migrants as legal proceedings continue. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Mark Sveta. The Pew Research Center, which we often draw from in this program, it's a very reliable resource. They've released a very interesting new survey on the current religious landscape of the United States. And one of the core findings, this is to put it in a nutshell here, is that societies tend to stay Christian longer if, as an entire society, they have the habit of respecting religious freedom. This is new evidence is showing this. Joining me to have this conversation is John Doherty. John is the Director of Finance of the Witherspoon Institute. John, I'm really glad to be speaking with you. How are you?
I'm fine, Dr. Peter. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And your piece in the public discourse resonates with a lot of the concerns I have as it pertains to understanding the role of faith in the life of societies, life of individuals and citizens within a state. And so in the United States of America, as the republic that we are, religious freedom is an enshrined reality, and that's perhaps why Christianity flourishes in America like no other nation.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case to me. I mean, others who are much more learned than I have said as much and have observed as much about the United States. I know, Catholics have always appreciated how when they came to this country, which had at least in the 1800s or so, and even the 1700s, when this country had a very different relationship to, say, the church, certainly the Catholic Church, than what Catholics were used to back in Europe, where many of the countries they came from, the church and the state had a very close partnership, whereas here things were a bit more open and, you know, people weren't sure what to expect, but I think over time, over generations, they found, hey, this works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
We're given freedom to worship God according to our conscience, and in fact, you know, we feel freer when we do it, so that kind of it takes hold longer. It's just more vibrant in some ways. Perhaps it's just different. But in any case, you know, Catholics experience that, you know, works pretty well. Unfortunately, today we see a lot of younger Christians wondering, hey, maybe this is a mistake. We see all this immorality in society. Maybe that's because, you know, we didn't have a closer relationship between church and state. Maybe we need to kind of rethink this.
Mm-hmm.
And what excited me about the Pew data, which again, this was not a headline that they came up with, but if you look at the data, it's there, I think. You compare, say, the parts of the country that had less religious freedom in the beginning versus parts that had more, and the parts that had more religious freedom, hey, look, people are more Christian there. Whereas in the other parts, say, New England, Christianity is now pretty weak,
mm-hmm.
Weaker than other places. So I just thought it was very interesting, some data to back up that intuition that, religion kind of works better in a context of political freedom.
Right. And so this highlights a number of talking points that we ought to be aware of as citizens of a free nation, and mm-hmm. that highlights individual liberty and freedom of expression. That's a constitutional right. But one of the core things I do want to point out here is, as you've rightly noted, staying Christian tends to be a societal prerogative as a result of a complete freedom, unfettered freedom of religion and expression. When a particular faith is mandated within a state and within or within a society at large, what tends to happen is it stifles the individual capacity for the pursuit of truth and therefore the freedom necessary to make one's assent of the faith, and that's why the faith tends to die. I just want to ask your thoughts on that.
I tend to think so. Again, I'm not an expert in the history. I mean, the history of the relations between church and state, say in Europe, you know, it's a very complicated one. It's very rare that you have a cases which are like, well, where, you know, the state is going out and stamping out people who are dissenting. Now, obviously, that flares up. It does flare up in certain instances in Europe, and obviously in this country, again, early on in New England, there was some of that. So it is complicated, but, you know, I think, as Christians, I think we just have to look back at, you know, how how Jesus, you know, approached the question of freedom.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, a very telling case is his dealings with, one, we can remember in the Garden of Gethsemane when the soldiers come to seize him, you know, St. Peter, of all people, tries to take out a sword and sort of try to defend Christ that way, and he immediately stops him from doing that, because, like, that's not what my kingdom is about. My kingdom is not a kingdom of this world, because he wants people to fall in love with him. And, you know, that's a very, you know, intimate, you know, thing, you know. The person's, you know, relationship with God, where that really needs, you know, a freedom, interior freedom, to achieve that. Now, at the same time, we still need to have law and order in society. You know, right? St. Peter would tell people in his epistle that we need to respect the authorities and honor them because, you know, they keep justice in society, and that's good. So we can't have people going around killing each other or stealing or things like that. But when it comes to these questions of the transcendent, which go beyond the natural law, say the supernatural law of grace, well, there, you know, their freedom is the appropriate manner of operating.
Right. And that's why when we consider, for example, the historical juxtaposition of the development of, say, the Puritans versus the Quakers, that sense of freedom within the society tended to spell the longevity and flourishing of those particular religious sects in society.
Yes, I mean, I think so. It's interesting with the Quakers. I mean, they have lasted a long time. You know, that it was really the first 100 years when they were in the Delaware Valley, as in Philadelphia and its surroundings, where they were really the dominant group. You know, after a century or so, they actually became more withdrawn for complicated reasons. They kind of stepped out of political life. You know, today, you know, there probably aren't as many Quakers as there once were. They're not as much of a percentage of the society. But nevertheless, you know, there are, at least the point that I try to draw with the Pew studies, that the society that they created in around Philadelphia, you know, whoever comes first to a place ends up setting the tone for everyone who comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the first ones there, they set up the framework, they set up the first laws. So when new people come in, they've got to adapt to those laws. And so the newcomers, they're changed by them. But also, I think, one argument is that the reason why this culture lasted is because it was attractive. And in fact, the Quakers tended to attract people to Philadelphia who had been persecuted back in Europe or other places. The Quakers had been persecuted in England. And so they wanted to come to a place where they would finally be free to worship. So they did attract similar kinds of people. And these were all people who, you know, they took the gospel very seriously,
right.
So seriously that they were willing to live it even under persecution. And so when they came to Philadelphia and they found the society the Quakers had set up, they said, yes, this is what we want, this is good, so that even when the Quakers kind of move on in history as not being so center stage, that culture continues. Whereas opposed to, you know, if just think about it, if you're coming to the United States as an immigrant and say you're not... Say you think of, should I go to Boston? Well, I really can only go to Boston if I'm a Congregationalist, that is, that I'm a Puritan. So, well, I'm not, so I guess I have to go somewhere else.
Mm.
And so over time, for that first century or so, it's just one kind of people there in New England. And anyway, so that's kind of a separate story. But the point
is
that this culture continues in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
And you know, I think it's interesting that the data suggests that in some ways we're still seeing that effect today.
Right. My guest is John Doherty, Director of Finance of the Witherspoon Institute, and we're talking about how a new Pew survey has demonstrated that society stays Christian longer if it respects religious freedom. And John, I think you brought up a really crucial point that we need to address on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. We have a pope. I'm Dr. Marcus Peach, and on behalf of Ave Maria Radio, I want to echo our sentiments of rejoicing in the benevolence of our Lord in continuing to grant us a Holy Father to shepherd the bark of Peter. Upon this rock, Christ built his church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail. Let us give thanks to our Lord and also pray for Robert Cardinal Prevost, who is now Pope Leo XIV, the 267th successor to the Holy Chair of Peter. God's hand remains upon his covenant family on earth. Deo gratias.
Spring into mowing season with a new Cub Cadet lawn tractor from Weingarts. We've been helping families like yours choose the right power equipment since 1945. Cub Cadet XT Enduro Series tractors are engineered to offer the best combination of quality, value, and performance. Cub Cadet lawn and garden tractors offer comfort and year-round versatility. Stop by our stores to help find your next Cub Cadet or visit us online at Weingarts.com. From our family to yours, thank you for letting us serve you.
Weingarts! Weingarts! Everything!
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, John Doherty. We are talking about his recent piece in the public discourse, wherein John discusses how society stays Christian longer if it respects religious freedom. So, John, you had presented this reality earlier that especially the New England case is a particularly unique one in terms of history, and it tends to be the case that if a particular region tends to be homogenous in terms of its expression of an expression, you know, a variation of Christian faith, it tends to stay that way. However, as religious freedom flourishes, and so a plurality of expressions within the Christian community flourishes, what that tends to happen is it bolsters different communities in their faith. So just build on that for us, as you shared earlier.
Sure. One thing that diversity certainly does is that, you know, say if one group of Christians starts to weaken, for whatever reason, they start having fewer children or they attract fewer converts, you know, the Christian character of the whole society doesn't go down because they're not the only ones kind of helping out, as it were, leavening society. Now, I think another thing that diversity contributes to is that, well, for one thing, if no group is getting extra privileges or sort of money or help with from the state to like enforce their beliefs, you know, by the civil law, well, you know, they've got to have a pure intention in what they do. They've got to work harder at being, you know, good, holy people themselves so that they can attract converts. And that's the best way to do it. And, you know, if you don't have sort of civil authority backing you up, you're kind of incentivized to do that because you have no other option. And so that can end up, again, incentivizing people to be more sincere, to be better people, to be better examples, and therefore better Christians. And so it's kind of, you know, you don't want to be crass and talk. In America, you know, we like talking about the free market or the market of this, because our economy is a very free one. We talk about the marketplace of ideas. I think there's a valid place to talk about the marketplace of religion.
Right.
And that, you know, if you're going to try to attract people to the truth, you've got to present it the best you can. And there's more of an incentive to do that if you don't have this extraneous help from, I don't know, a political power, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, There's other things that have been said about this, but I mean, those are just a few thoughts there.
Yeah, and I think that brings up, that opens up the horizon of a kind of application of natural law principles to our consideration of how the Christian faith propagates. Because what you're introducing here ostensibly is, and rightly in your expertise, the principles of free market ideas as it pertains to religious flourishing. And like I said, rightly so. Human ingenuity, human nature tends to see a need and fill a need, and that's one of the core principles of markets and free markets. And there's some truth to be said about that when it comes to the expression of man's participation in Judeo-Christian principles. And so within a society wherein there is enshrined freedom of religion and therefore an allowance for an expressive of a plurality of expressions, what that tends to do is it fosters growth in these particular communities for staying Christian longer, even if there is a transformation in what that looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a long precedent for this. Even within, say, when people think of the Catholic Church, they think, oh, there's a religious monolith. Everyone believes the same things and does the same things. It's all the same. Now, in part, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Because, there's one creed, there's one, set of teachings. There is one set of sacraments. There's the Mass. But within that, there's a lot of diversity.
Yes.
You think about who are more different than the Franciscans from the Dominicans, Jesuits. I mean, that's a lot of diversity. Mm-hmm. And that diversity makes the church strong. I mean, it does create over time some healthy competition between orders.
Right.
Right now, sometimes it gets crass and it gets uncharitable. But, people, we need some incentive to get out of ourselves to say, hey, we're not attracting more young novices. This other group is attracting them more. Why is that?
Mm.
And it's like, well, they seem to be practicing asceticism a lot, and that seems to be attracting people. Or they're very courageous in speaking the truth, or they're going to these very challenging mission territories. So, maybe we need to think about, in our order or our part of the church, whatever it is, maybe we need to examine our consciences. And, that's just, I think, God kind of, builds that part of the design. That's kind of what makes it over time grow and flourish, and it gets messy at the same time, but in the long run, it's shown itself to be very durable. And again, I think the American context is very similar to that. There are a lot of analogies there. I know we're talking about kinds of Protestantism here, Quakerism versus Puritanism, but, each of them is still retained part of the Christian heritage in some way. Catholics would say there's not the fullness there, but there is still part of it there.
Right.
Again, I think the Quakers' insight into freedom of conscience, that's an ancient part of the church's tradition. That's why Dignitatis Humanae basically enshrines that, upholding that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
In fact, Dignitatis Humanae is very explicit about how once one begins talking about human liberty, the liberty of individuals, it inevitably overflows into the question of expression of faith as it pertains to individual liberty and flourishing. There's no denying it. A free person is a person who will start deciding for themselves, in their own discernment of truth and conscience, what faith they want to express. And so, and just to build on the point you brought up, you're right, there are a tremendous amount of differences between the Dominicans and the Franciscans. And so the question becomes one of substance versus one of, so substance and accidents, but really it becomes the core identity versus expression. And the same is true for a Judeo-Christian nation. The allowance of freedom of expression means that at its core, we still have these undergirding Judeo-Christian principles that become the framework upon which society is built. And it's from there, these enshrined freedoms that come from God himself, that man is now given the liberty, ostensibly the liberty to be for themselves what their consciences lead them to be in the right pursuit and exercise of their prudence. So, yeah, just comment on that.
Sure. That makes a whole lot of sense to me. And I mean, some people might respond to that and say, well, that just seems like relativism. Everyone just, you know, follow your conscience. And in the end, it's like, well, right. You know, we've got to abide by basic justice, mm-hmm. basic natural law. And, you know, the natural law, the whole idea is that these are things we can't not know. So, you know, someone can't, we can't just let someone off say, well, I murdered my neighbor, but, you know, I thought it was the right thing to do. It's like, no, that doesn't work that way.
Right, right.
You know, it is delicate. And Dignitatis Humanae acknowledges that because at some point it says, you know, people are going to read this and they're going to say, well, doesn't that seem to allow license and people do whatever they want? And the bishops say in the document, well, then all the more reason then, right, we need to be educating people well in basic virtues and basic natural law.
Right.
Because, right, it is hard to draw the line between where the boundary between sort of where conscience gets freedom in matters of religion and where, you know, freedom needs to be checked through the civil law. And there is not an easy answer. So it's, again, as James Madison once said, you know, only an educated people can be a truly free people. And I think, or John Adams saying our Constitution was made only for religious people. I think one point to take away from there is that there is no substituting for virtue.
Right.
A society can't just have set up clear rules and just follow them. We need to be educating our children, ourselves in virtue throughout our lives so that they have the wisdom to distinguish between the right and the wrong kind of freedom.
Right. Well, John, it was a tremendous joy to speak with you. Thank you very much for your insights on this very important conversation.
Oh, you're welcome, Dr. Peter. My pleasure.
My guest, John Doherty, Director of Finance of the Witherspoon Institute. Let's keep our nation free that it may stay Christian. I'm Marcus Peter.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
Beckway Door is a top provider of garage doors as well as home entry, patio, and storm doors. Locally owned since 1978, we give free, no-pressure quotes at prices 20% lower than most competitors and often provide same-day service for garage door repairs. Mention Ave Maria Radio for 10% off the replacement or service of your garage door or the installation of new exterior doors. Visit BeckwayDoor.com. That's BeckwayDoor.com.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood, but you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
Hello, Steve Ray here from Footprints of God Pilgrimages. Want to celebrate some amazing anniversaries this year in France? We'll visit Normandy Beach to celebrate our heroic military for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. Also, the 100th anniversary of the canonization of St. Teresa of Lisieux. Join us this October for our Saints and Shrines of France and a visit to the newly renovated Notre Dame Cathedral.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
Do you wish you could have discussions about difficult topics with your adult children? If so, don't worry. You're not alone. Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. And our book, Having Meaningful, Sometimes Difficult Conversations with Your Adult Sons and Daughters, can help you draw closer to your adult children and help guide them on the path to more faithful and meaningful lives.
You can get our latest book and all of our other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
This week on Christ is the Answer, Father John talks about how to strengthen our relationships. The fact that people today are so distant from one another is not a mundane detail we can just ignore. With so many tools that were supposed to bring us together, it has only aided in driving us apart from one another and fueled the desire for the disposable. Join us this week as Father John talks about the importance of friendship and how to strengthen all of our relationships. Tune in for Christ is the Answer Monday through Fridays at 11 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Daria Little was born and raised in Muslim Turkey, but after her parents' divorce, she rejected her faith, wandered the wilderness of atheism looking for her home. During her stormy adolescence, she tried to convince a Christian missionary that there was no God, but converted to Christ instead. She shares her story with us today. Daria is the author of From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. You can follow her work at darialittle.com. Daria, great to speak with you. How are you?
Hi, very good. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm joyous to be able to have this conversation with you. And just to provide you a little bit of context, I grew up in a heavily Sunni Muslim environment and was coerced into conversion many times while growing up. And I was an atheist myself, so I didn't believe in a God. So your story resonates with me very personally. And I want to start by, first of all, saying I'm glad you're home in the embrace of Christ. And secondly, just to introduce our listeners to some conceptual issues that you would have faced, just talk about very briefly, in a very basic way, the reason why the God of Islam and the God of Christianity are vastly different.
I think this is very hard for Westerners who mm-hmm. grew up still somewhat of a in a Christian culture,
mm-hmm.
Because even in a secular society, there is this understanding of general goodness and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very hard to understand. But one of the things I try to explain in my book is this this understanding of servile fear. St. Thomas talks
yeah.
about it against. Filial fear, and of course, servile fear in itself isn't good, but it can't be the ultimate end. And in Muslim societies, that servile fear is the ruling force.
Right.
And I remember taking History of the South when I was still studying in Turkey, and we had all these American students who said, "How come the slaves didn't rise up, right, during the Civil War?" And I was like, of course they wouldn't rise up because they were paralyzed by servile fear.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up in a Muslim country, that understanding of master and slave relationship between
right.
Allah and Muslim and a male and female and father and son
mm-hmm.
is the most important thing. You learn it from a very, very young age.
Right.
And St. Thomas talks about how servile fear should always lead to filial fear,
mm-hmm.
or it is not good, right? Even in act of contrition, we talked about it. Like, it's not perfect contrition if you're fearing hell, right? That's servile fear,
right?
Right? The fear of punishment, fear of the master. But you need to fear disappointing your father who loves you more than anything else. Right, that is God the Father. So that is the difference. Like, one is a Allah is a master.
Yes.
And God the Father is a father, which is also a concept that most Muslims will just cannot even think about.
Right.
Imagine Allah as their father. And I think that is the most important difference. And it is very hard for Muslims to break that mold and to see God as Christ teaches and talks about his own father.
Yeah. In fact, very early on in the Quran, chapter 5, there's very clear language there about repudiation of any notion of fatherhood in God, sonship in God. And so it's a rejection of Christ, this language of that Allah is one. You know, the Tawhid, right? Allah is one. There's completely, absolutely no delineation in his essence. And now, mind you, I understand the Christian faith does in fact teach that there is no separation in the essence, but Islam doesn't even have categories for that. And because of that, the language we have in Christianity, like God is Father, we are children of God, it simply doesn't exist outside of a Judeo-Christian framework.
No, it's unthinkable because, I mean, the created world is also, I don't know, this is this may be a Gnostic element within the most religious. The created world is dirty, right? Evil, just unworthy of divinity. So think that God would become incarnate, become part of us, lower himself so much, it's almost like he's not worthy of being God anymore.
Right.
If that makes sense. Whereas we see it as like this expression of his infinite love for us. They see this like, clearly you're not God if you're just willing to come to our level. So it's just, it's a completely different perception.
Right.
And the Trinity and the Incarnation are the two most important pillars of Christianity that Muslims reject. So it's very hard for them to see it before we show them this. Before we can show them that they are stuck in that almost a prison of that servile fear.
Right. Because that language of Abdul Allah, you know, when you convert, that language of you are a slave of Allah, that's what Islam is, right? To be a follower of Muhammad, to be a worshiper of Allah, is to accept slavish obedience that's voluntaristic to the point of not reasoning through what you're asked for. Do this, and that's what Allah says, and that's essentially the whole Islamic law.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And that is also, it permeates in every level of the society.
Mm-hmm.
So that relationship between Allah and the Muslim, that slave and master, is expected everywhere. You're not allowed to question. You're not allowed to doubt at all. And that is taught to every Muslim child that this is what the Quran is.
Yeah.
You cannot doubt. This is who Muhammad is. You cannot even imagine what he looks like. You're not even allowed to picture Muhammad or Allah. So there's no room for questioning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Christianity, we're like, okay, if you're willing to hear the truth, we always encourage you to ask questions, to get to know God who loves you so much more. And I, like you said, that master and slavery relationship is so essential to Islam that it just is everywhere, even within the society itself.
Right. And so when I read through this book, and I, especially your childhood narratives, Daria, one of the things I picked up very early on is you were not given even the space to engage your reason in anywhere from asking questions to pondering the metaphysical reality that you were asked to believe in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Again, that is there isn't much of a metaphysical background to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a consistent understanding of sin.
Right.
Right. So, Allah can do whatever he wants. So it's just, once you start asking questions, it's a house of cards.
Mm-hmm.
It just starts collapsing. So they try very hard because of this servile fear.
Right.
They just, you don't even go near asking questions, but because as children, we want to believe in what our, you know, elders and parents teach us.
Yep.
And the society, the family is still very intact in most Muslim countries, that it just still remains. So once we are grown and our reason hasn't been engaged for a long time, it's very hard to break that mold.
Yeah.
For me, that questioning came when my parents got a divorce and everything kind of shattered around me, then I started questioning. I kind of broke that mold of fear.
Right.
But until then, I was a completely content Muslim girl. And I probably remain that way if my parents didn't get a divorce and kind of shatter my own worldview. And I think that kind of being stuck in that mentality of you can't ask questions, you can't doubt, is very foreign to for Westerners to understand, but it's very real in every Muslim's mind, even as grown-ups.
Yeah. And so in reading your book and realizing what you've gone through, it becomes very clear that there are a few tenets that Islam holds as absolute and need to stand on. A rejection of Trinity, rejection of the incarnation and crucifixion, and also rejection of reason. We are continuing this conversation with Daria Little, who holds a doctorate in politics from Durham University in England, and she is the author of From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Riddles of God. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, and I'm speaking with Daria Little, the author of From Islam to Christ. So, Daria, we had established certain parameters here of understanding the stark differences between Islam and Christianity, and I have to admit, it's a difficult conversation to have with those who have lived in Western civilization, because whether they try to or not, accidentally or axiomatically, what winds up happening is they view the entire world through the Judeo-Christian perspective, the presupposition of a moral good and adherence to natural law, the presupposition of a common good and the dignity of human life. And it's almost as if they can't fathom a worldview outside of that. But the truth is, the Eastern philosophical traditions, and Islam in particular, don't lend themselves to participations in those realities.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think, in a way, those metaphysical realities are taken for granted in the U.S. When I moved here for the first time, I was so kind of puzzled with the fact that this feminist movement completely ignored the plight of Muslim women and the sufferings of Muslim women, because I don't think they were able to see that how much of that philosophical background they borrowed from Christianity itself.
Right.
So I agree, most Westerners don't see and even fathom, like you said, that a different worldview.
And because of that, you had tremendous struggles overcoming that entire worldview, and even in your move to into Western civilization and the education that you had.
Yes, but I was grateful in a different way when I became an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
The popular thing among Turkish atheists was to read these books we called the classics back then.
Mm-hmm.
And little did I know, these are the great books, like the great books traditions.
Yeah.
After all these years, when I started homeschooling my own kids, I realized, oh, this is the stuff I read when I was an atheist. But what happened is there is just so much timeless truth and beauty and goodness in these great works that stood the test of time.
Yeah.
These fictional works prepared me for the reception of the gospel when I heard it for the first time. So if that makes, I think that's it. That's for us, especially now that we are moving away from this Christian worldview, that is something we can still hold on to. And it really helped me to move from that atheist worldview to a first Protestant, then Catholic worldview. And even after moving to the West, because my conversion happened in Turkey,
mm-hmm.
It just prepared me in a philosophical way. And we all need that background to be able to understand theology,
yeah.
Right? That we need that basis before we can properly understand theology.
You know, I read your story, and you very quickly took to the exercise of reason, the principle of non-contradiction, and the pursuit of objective truth. How much did the influence of Pope Benedict XVI affect you in your own journey into Christianity and the Catholic faith?
It's interesting because I think the Lord created me that way, and the things I read early on as an atheist, they also kind of build that foundation. But Pope Benedict XVI was one of the first Catholics whose writings I read and failed to completely understand. That's for sure. I remember I was still in the process of converting, and I was living in Ankara, and he visited Turkey, and I had to walk back to my dorm room for like 5 miles, and I was like, this Catholic stuff better be true if I am suffering this for this Pope. And I was very interested in his writings, and I like the way he writes in a linear way, right? It's very systematic and linear way, and that really helped me understand it in a progression. As you know, Eastern way of writing is a lot more cyclical repetitive. And Pope Benedict has been a great influence in my life.
Yeah, circular, repetitive, but under the guise of being profound and mystical. And the application of something like the principle of non-contradiction, you start piercing through it. But that's just a comment. What I'd like to ask you then is, in 2006, when he delivered his Regensburg address, I was having trouble tracking the timeline of where you were. How much did that address affect you? Because the entire Islamic world took that address up in arms after he delivered it.
Yes, because, so when you're a Muslim and you grow up in this, like, you cannot criticize anything.
Yep.
And then that comes across as you cannot criticize anything any Muslim ever did, almost, if that makes sense.
Right.
And everything he said, if you go back and read it in its entirety, was true.
Yep.
Historical. You know, he's very he's never going to put out something that contradicts the faith or the truth or the, you know, history. So, any insult to Muslim nations or Allah or Muhammad, they take very personal.
Right.
So I was still in Turkey, and your first reaction as a Christian living in a Muslim country is like, ooh, don't stir the pot.
Right, I remember.
So that's your first inclination. But after a while, as you know, that is like, this is the truth, and sometimes it needs to be said, and sometimes the pot needs to be stirred. And I know there are many people who converted to Christianity just from being mad at Christians, right? It's like, why would he ever say that? And then you start, you know, slowly digging, and then you come to the truth. But yes, they don't take criticism very kindly, and that's very normal and expected.
Yeah, and so in considering that and what you had to deal with in terms of, you know, in this case, Pope Benedict XVI being truly magnificent in highlighting this historical reality, one thing he does wind up, it's subtle, he doesn't point it out explicitly, but he does point out that there was this stark difference between the Islam that Muhammad preaches in Mecca and the Islam that it evolves to in Medina. And what happened in the interim was the amassing of tremendous military might. How did that affect you in your study from Islam, atheism, into Christianity?
So Muhammad, it's very interesting to read his life. Not very pleasant, but definitely interesting. When he was living in Mecca, I think he truly believed that whatever he was hearing from this supposed angel Gabriel was the truth. And then he was just another prophet in a line of prophets, right? Like Moses, you know, David and Jesus. And so he was very, I think he really thought that all these Christians and Jews now would start following him, and he would gather this crowd. And from, again, this is he was surrounded by Nestorian Christians because
right.
a lot of Nestorians fled that way. So what happened that obviously he was rejected by yeah. the Christians and the Jews. And then when he moved to Mecca and gathered force, his worldview completely changed in that way.
Yeah.
So and then he realized that if he promised men what they are after on this earth
right.
and, the, you know, after life, then he can gather this force around him. And like I remember one of the things I read that was very jarring for me was the first villages that they plundered, Muslims. And I remember reading this. This is from the Hadith, right? From the writings of Muslims about
mm-hmm.
Muhammad's life. I read it without the scales before my eyes. And I was like, oh, this is not a defensive war. He sought out these people to convert them. And when he, they rejected him, he killed a man and enslaved the women and children.
Right.
And but this is all seen as a legitimate way of conquering and converting people. So there's a different, definite shift between the way he wanted to spread his faith in Mecca and Medina. But after that, once he gathered that military force, that was the dominant way. And he gathered many men around him. Yes, and it was very hard for me to see that, hey, he's not defending himself, because that's what we were always taught, that Muhammad only fought just wars,
right, right.
wars of defense. He was, you know, very, you know, he was a just man, right? That was, he's the ideal man. But when you read it with open eyes, then you realize, no, that is just simply not the truth.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're running out of time here. Just very quickly, Daria, I'm going to encourage people to procure a copy of your book, From Islam to Christ, published by Ignatius Press. But very quickly, for Catholics who are listening right now, who want to gain a better understanding about how to think about Islam rightly, what would you say in about a minute or so?
Yes, definitely. The Quran is very hard to read. I would not start
yeah, yeah.
there. There's a book, again, by, published by Ignatius Press. If they already know basics of Islam, I found this book perfect. It's called The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch.
Right, right.
It's an excellent book, and it will help everyone understand how everything evolved and what they resulted. But if they have Muslims in their lives, one of the best ways to start is to practice and learn our own faith, because all Muslims approach Christians in general with suspicion and of duplicity and lying. But our faithful lives are a great witness. So learn your own faith, leave your own faith, and then, The Crucifix on Mecca's Front Porch is an excellent book.
Thank you so much, Daria. My guest, Daria Little. She holds a PhD in politics from Durham University in England. She's the author of From Islam to Christ, One Woman's Path Through the Rills of God. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.